Participating in the Pacifica Bylaws Amendment vote and referendum. Many of you are not aware of the results, and so I'm here to share those with you. 65.2% voted no, and 34.8% voted yes. There are more detailed information on your local station website, as well as on pacifica.org. We also may have one to two more opportunities to vote for amending various portions of the bylaws this year. Thank you again for your continued support of the Pacifica Foundation and all of five stations. Thank you.
Hey, this is Shaka Khan, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
This is the Joy of Resistance, Multicultural Feminist Radio at WBAI. I'm Fran Luck. I am here with Halsey Hazard, and we have a very special show for you tonight. Tonight we're going to be looking at a story of that is so epic that it spans three generations. It is the story of the fight, the three-generation-long, 75-year-long fight for the right of women to vote. We are in the centennial year, 100 years since that fight was won, or some would say one stage of that fight was won in 1920. It's now 100 years later. And that story spanned much political history of the United States. The women who started it did not live to see the end of it. And through most of it, it was considered to be a completely hopeless cause, leading to the question of how did they persist. Our guest tonight has written one of the best books on the subject. Her name is Professor Ellen Carol Du Bois, and we're going to have her on the phone live for the bulk of the show. And we will be offering you an autographed copy of her book just out in February. That is considered one of the best books, if not the best book, on the subject. She's been writing about it for a long, long time and really knows her stuff. So we're going to get a good handle on it tonight. This autographed copy of her hardcover book, illustrated and with everything you ever wanted to know about how that struggle for the vote was won, will be yours for a pledge to support WBAI of $60. So, before we go to our guest and the story of this amazing, amazing fight that took place over so many years, even generations, which is a great example to the struggles we're in today, before we go to that, we're going to go to our feminist news roundup. So please stay tuned. On May 6th, Trump-appointed Education Secretary Betsy DeVos announced the Department of Education's new rules for dealing with sexual assault on campus. These new rules, set to go into effect in August of 2020, overturn Obama-era guidance designed to protect students from sexual assault in favor of protections for those accused of sexual assault. The regulations give college students accused of assault the right to have representatives cross-examine their accusers in a live hearing, which advocacy organizations say will discourage survivors from coming forward. The regulations also reduce colleges' responsibilities to investigate allegations, only requiring investigations for complaints made to certain designated employees, such as Title IX coordinators, through a formal process. The definition of sexual harassment is narrowed to include only misconduct that is, quote, so severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive, close quote, that it effectively denies the victim access to the school's education programs. The rules do add dating violence, domestic violence, and stalking to the definition of sexual harassment. The Obama administration, by contrast, used a wider definition that included a range of conduct that, quote, interferes with or limits a student's access to the school. It said that it could include unwelcome sexual advances, request for sexual favors, and other verbal, nonverbal, or physical conduct of a sexual nature, close quote. The plan has drawn widespread criticism from feminist and sexual assault survivor organizations, as well as 17 state attorneys general and education organizations who had asked for a delay while we are in the midst of the coronavirus crisis. The new rules are the result of a long-running effort by the Trump administration to overhaul Title IX, a federal law banning discrimination in education, which in recent years has included women being subject to sexual harassment and assault as a form of interference in their right to an education. Under President Obama, colleges were required to have processes in place to combat sexual assault and harassment or risk losing federal funding. The National Women's Law Center has announced it will sue the Department of Education over the DeVos plan. In an op-ed, NWLC President Fatima Ghost Graves and NAACP President Derek Johnson wrote, quote, DeVos's Title IX rules would make it harder for students who are sexually harassed to receive vital support and protection while mandating unfair processes for investigating and addressing sexual harassment. All these changes would particularly hurt black women and girls who face even higher stakes when reporting sexual harassment. Both of our organizations have stated again and again that an attack on Title IX is an attack on civil rights. The op-ed goes on. DeVos's rules would forbid students from proactively addressing sexual violence, forcing too many student survivors into a broken criminal legal system in order to hold their abusers accountable. While some may choose to report their assaults to law enforcement, this cannot be the only option for survivors. Close quote.
And also on May 6th, the United States Supreme Court heard oral arguments in two cases seeking to challenge the Affordable Care Act mandate that birth control be covered in employer-based health insurance. The two cases, Trump v. Pennsylvania and Little Sisters of the Poor v. Pennsylvania, are the latest attempt by the Trump administration to satisfy their base by denying women the constitutional right to abortion and birth control. The cases are a response to Pennsylvania's rejection of Trump administration rules that included an exception for employers with so-called sincerely held moral convictions opposed to coverage of some or all contraceptive or sterilization methods, close quote. And that is an exemption which Pennsylvania attorney Michael Fisher told the New York Times, quote, could in theory allow an employer who objects to women in the workforce at all, for instance, to remove itself from providing contraception, end quote. Rewire.news law and the court's vice president and frequent Joy of Resistance guest, Jessica Mason-Pieklo, writes, quote, conservative attacks on the birth control benefit have never been about a religious objection to providing contraception. They're about trying to wedge open new ways for businesses to avoid complying with all sorts of regulations. The willingness of the Obama administration to continuously try and accommodate every new bad faith objection conservatives raised to the birth control benefit didn't help either. But with the Trump administration, those motives are now crystal clear. This is an administration that believes businesses should not have to play by any rules especially the ones that equalize benefits among their employees the way that the birth control benefit does, end quote. And while it remains unclear how the Supreme Court will rule, it is likely that the new conservative majority will side with employers and the Trump administration in their attempts to use religious tolerance as an excuse for extending the power of employers into their employees' personal lives, which is a situation that will have disastrous medical and economic effects for women.
And as people around the country celebrate Mother's Day, as we did just yesterday, the COVID-19 pandemic continues to make clear what feminists have always known. A one-day celebration with flowers and cards won't cut it. What mothers need is comprehensive, universal child care 365 days a year. The United States has long lagged behind the rest of the developed world in child care access, and the COVID-19 epidemic has exacerbated the problem as millions of parents are now forced to shelter in place with young children with the closing of schools and child care centers. Child care centers across the country, which overwhelmingly employ working class women, many of them immigrants, have been forced to close due to present low enrollment and lack of financial support. The CARES, C-A-R-E-S, COVID-19 Stimulus Act passed last month provides $3.5 billion in stimulus funding for the child care industry, but the National Women's Law Center and other feminist groups have pointed out that the child care industry and the women who work in it and rely on it will need much more assistance, and the child care is central to our economy and the well-being of all. Senators Elizabeth Warren and Tina Smith have announced a new plan to guarantee $50 billion in stimulus money to provide child care to essential workers, keep child care workers employed, and ensure long-lasting changes in the child care industry post-pandemic, such as improving child care infrastructure, as well as increasing wages for child care workers. In their announcement, they write, quote, "When the time comes, we will not be able to rebuild our economy if this country's child care system has collapsed beneath the economic burden of this pandemic. When the economy can start to safely get back on track, millions of parents will not be able to return to work or reopen their own small businesses if they cannot find safe, affordable, and reliable care for their children. And if child care providers must close their doors for months, we risk permanently reducing the supply of child care in this country," close quote.
It has now been nearly 2 months since Tara Reid alleged that former vice president and current presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden sexually assaulted her, sparking massive debate, which has only accelerated, over the validity of her claims and what should become of Joe Biden's candidacy if Reid is to be believed. In an official statement released on May 1st, Biden said of the incident, quote, "This never happened," close quote, and called for the media to, quote, "examine and evaluate the full and growing record of inconsistencies in her story, which has changed repeatedly in both small and big ways," end quote. The New York Times and several other major publications, however, have undertaken serious investigations into her claims and have so far found upwards of five credible witnesses and no damning inconsistencies in her story. On May 7th, the San Luis Obispo Tribune uncovered a document from Reid's 1996 divorce from her former husband, in which he wrote that Reid had mentioned, quote, "a problem she was having at work regarding sexual harassment in U.S. Senator Joe Biden's office," end quote, and that Reid, quote, "eventually struck a deal with the chief of staff of the senator's office and left her position. It was obvious that this event had a very traumatic effect on her and that she is still sensitive and affected by it," end quote. Meanwhile, Reid herself has joined the growing number of calls for Joe Biden to drop out of the presidential race, telling NBC anchor Megyn Kelly, quote, "Please step forward and be held accountable. And if you don't feel that you can address this in a real way," this is addressing Joe Biden, "then you and I know that you should step down."
Wow. Wow. What a conundrum we're in, huh, Halsey? We have a choice between two credibly accused rapists, or we have the guy who is running rampage over every single progressive issue and destroying the Constitution. What a choice. Well, this will obviously go on and possibly escalate, and we will be keeping track of it. And that is some of the feminist news. We're keeping it short tonight because we're so excited to be getting to our guest very shortly, who is Ellen Carol Du Bois, who has written one of the best books on the 75-year struggle to get the vote for women. And we're going to find out why it took so long, among other things. Please do stay tuned.
And an ERA. Very quickly then, a song by Eddie Grogan from Indianapolis Now. It's a song that quotes a famous three-word phrase that Susan B. Anthony uttered years ago. Do you know what that phrase is? All right.
You're listening to a little bit of Kristen Lem's great rendition of Failure is Impossible, based on a saying by Susan B. Anthony. And she had to believe failure was impossible because, boy, what a journey she had ahead of her, not to mention the two successive generations of women who came after her. And it took all of their efforts to finally get that win of the vote. And I am really pleased to have on the line the author of an incredible book on that whole epic struggle. And her name is Ellen Carol Du Bois, and I'm going to tell you about her. She's a distinguished research professor in the history department of UCLA. She's the author of numerous books on the history of women's suffrage in the U.S. She's the co-author with Lynn Dumanil of the leading textbook on women's history called Through Women's Eyes, An American History with Documents, and with co-editor Vicky Ruiz of a book called Unequal Sisters, an inclusive reader in women's history. That's a great book on class and women. She also wrote Feminism and Suffrage, The Emergence of an Independent Women's Movement in America, 1848 to 1869. Woman Suffrage and Women's Rights, she wrote that in 1998. Harriet Stanton Blatch and the Winning of Women's Suffrage, and Votes for Women, a 75th anniversary album. Wow. Welcome to Joy of Resistance, Professor Du Bois. So glad to have you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Let's go to Ellen so things will be easier.
Wonderful, Ellen. I'm grateful for that. So, yeah, boy, what an epic story. I mean, this is pretty amazing. And what I understand you have done is you've kind of tackled some of the myths about it. It's amazing how much we can have a sort of fresh look at it after this time. And you also speak about how that struggle did not just end in 1920. We are, in a certain sense, still living out the legacy of it, and the end decision about what it really was is maybe going to be determined by our actions. So, congratulations on this incredible historical work. Thank you so much.
Thank you a lot. Means a lot.
You're really welcome. You're really welcome. Let me begin by telling our audience that you can actually get a copy of this book during this program by calling our line, our pledge line, at 516-320-3602. 516. Do I have that right, Max? I always mess that up. It's 516-620, right? 3602. And you can also get that on Give to WBAI. on our website. That's at give2wbai.org. And that's for a pledge of $60. And the great treat about it is that we have 5 autographed copies signed by the author. And by the time we're finished with this interview, you're going to want one. But those 5 copies are going to go fast. And that's why I'm making this announcement at the beginning. And I'm sorry for my bad phone here. In going to remote broadcasting, we are still, all of us are still adjusting. Let me just say that. Anyway. Ellen, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, I haven't lost here. You. So sorry. So
I'm sitting here in my 3 hours before you, looking out at the evening, the setting sun in California.
Oh, my goodness. Kind of wish I was there. Anyway, glad you are. So it's hard for most activists today to imagine a struggle that took 75 years. In the book, you talk about the many different eras of U.S. history that took place during that long time when women were fighting for the vote, starting with the abolition movement before the Civil War, then through Reconstruction, through the Progressive Era, as it was called, and that the suffrage movement was shaped by all these different eras and also helped to shape them. So can you just give us an overview to begin with, to kind of fill out the picture so we can get a handle on how to see this struggle?
Yeah, well, it's a complex story, but I'll do my best to do it quickly. When the movement started in 1848, it's advocated by a very small group of very advanced women, all of whom are connected in one way or another to the movement to end slavery. But it's just a tiny movement of radicals. And the association is between the freedom of black people from slavery and the freedom of what the important early feminist Angelina Grimke called, talking about white women, nominally free women. And I would say that that period goes up through the Civil War. I would like to point out one of those sort of realizations I had while I was writing this book, which is that you're going to get to some of the complexities about race and suffrage, women's suffrage, in a few minutes. But I don't think it's sufficiently appreciated that the leaders of the suffrage movement in the middle of the Civil War, particularly Elizabeth Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, and Lucy Stone, gathered together a movement of women who collected over 100,000 signatures and sent them to Congress for a constitutional amendment abolishing slavery. That was the 13th Amendment. And it's the first time that there was ever a popular movement on behalf of a mm-hmm. constitutional amendment. This first period will take us up through the years right after the Civil War and through the terrible and I would say tragic circumstances which lead to the break between the freedom of African Americans and of women. That's not even a good way to put it, because in between those two groups are black women. But in any case, I would go on to the next period, which actually you didn't mention. It's a sort of strange period in American history, usually called the Gilded Age. It's a term that Mark Twain invented. The 80s and the 90s, that's 1880s and 1890s. It's a very conservative period. It's actually strangely encouraging to learn about it, because it's yet another period in American history, like the one we're living in which great and radical changes are necessarily followed by extremely conservative reaction. So it's this not the first time we've been through this rodeo. Mm-hmm. That's a period in which the underlying energies of the suffrage movement become what at one early point in my life I considered more conservative. But really what's happening is that the suffrage movement is going from being a movement of a handful of already confirmed radicals to a larger and larger, to the beginnings of a mass movement among American women. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you noticed this in the book, but one of the interesting things is that the real first campaign that made suffrage a mass movement of conventional, common, small town, Christian, Protestant women was led by the Women's Christian Temperance Union, which we hardly think of as a feminist organization.
Yeah.
But that was a really crucial period. And then in the late 19th and early 20th century, American political radicalism, or let's say progressivism, literally, revives. These are the last 25 years of the suffrage movement. Now, this is still a period, a very backward period in American racial relations. Probably a lot of your listeners know about Birth of a Nation, which was developed in these years.
Right.
Even President Wilson, who we think of as a progressive, was very, very backward on race relations. But it was also true that these years, the late 19th and early 20th century years, were very progressive years for class. And this is when the working class, particularly European immigrant white working women, who make up the great majority of American women workers, wage workers, come into the suffrage movement and make it a movement that can fill the streets of New York with 10,000 women. And it is really this that finally helps to bring the suffrage movement to completion.
That is just incredible. Of course, in my summary that I threw to you, I also left out, of course, the very beginning, the official beginning of the fight for suffrage, which was the Seneca Falls Convention of 1848, in which the demand for the vote was considered far too radical and impossible by most of the people who attended, and they were some of the most progressive people of the time. And it was Elizabeth Cady Stanton, with help from Frederick Douglass, that got that over the hump, right? And that became one of the demands, which is where the fight for the vote actually began. Am I correct?
Yes, you have it correct. And it should be remarked here that Frederick Douglass was the only man at that meeting who couldn't vote. All the other men were white and could vote.
Wow.
So he knew quite well what the lack of the right to vote meant.
That's right. And he was a major feminist throughout. And you know, just
throughout his life. It's,
yes.
A lot of attention has been paid lately to the terrible split between Stanton and Anthony on the one side and Douglass on the other, having to do with the 15th Amendment in 1869. And it is an important episode, and one that shouldn't be glossed over. But the relationship between Stanton and Douglass runs from 1840 until his death, which I'm forgetting, but it's, I think, 1893, something like that. They admired each other a great deal. Now, it's interesting. They were both, they both had a strong streak of elitism. I mean, they were very different. She came from a wealthy family. He was a slave. But they both, first of all, they both had an incredible love of and incredible way with words, is really the only thing that can be said. When you read his words or her words, you don't know you're in the middle of the 19th century. They both had a streak of elitism. They both thought of themselves as superior to the average run of human beings. What distinguished them is that they took that confidence, which is the only thing we can call it, and they brought it to bear on behalf of their people, in his case, African Americans, in her case, women. She once said that if it hadn't been for meeting Susan B. Anthony, she just would have sat in her armchair and read books. But Anthony taught her to take her sense of outrage and bring it to bear on the lives of all women.
Right. And let me interrupt you for a minute to inform our audience that we are Joy of Resistance, coming to you every week between 9 and 10 p.m. and bringing you frontline as well as historical analysis of the ever-ongoing feminist movement, the movement for women's full equal rights and human rights and liberation. And a huge part of that picture is what we're discussing right now with our guest, Ellen Carol Du Bois, who has written a great book on this subject. It is called Suffrage, Women's Long Battle for the Vote. Ellen Carol Du Bois, we have her live on the phone. It's a major book. It's said to be the book that people will go to for an authoritative view. I don't know if you feel comfortable being an authority, Ellen, but a lot of people think that your book will be. We are offering you a copy of this book, not only a copy, but an autographed copy, hardcover book. I believe it has some illustrations in it, and you can get that for a pledge of $60 to support listener-supported non-commercial radio, which is right now keeping us all connected at this time of a great deal of isolation because of social distancing. We really rely on it more than ever. So call us at 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602. While those 5 autographed copies last, you'll be able to get other copies after that, but right now those are the prizes. And you can also get that by going to give2wbai.org. And you'll see that on the website, and you can order it. And you can also become a WBAI buddy, which is a supporting member of WBAI. You can do it in the name of Joy of Resistance and the kind of quality programming that we bring you. And please do some or all of those things while we are going on with our conversation. So, Ellen Carol Du Bois, let's go back to this story. We've got now a feminist movement that has taken hold. You've brought it to the point even where it's becoming popularized, having started with a few radicals back in 1848. And there are many, many decades of struggle to go. Let's remember that the cause of getting votes for women was considered a hopeless cause during much of the struggle, and I was just amazed by finding that out only a few days ago. A hopeless cause. Let that inspire all of us. So there was also, obviously, it went on so long because there was enormous resistance to this demand for votes for women. And you say in the introduction, women's right to vote was consistently resisted for 75 years, with every political tool and specious argument known to man in state and federal constitutions, legislative debates, and voter referenda. And you also say men's active opposition lay at the root of that long history. So let's talk about the opposition and the ridicule. Where was it coming from? And does that kind of ridicule survive even today?
Well, yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, I think I concluded after writing this book, and actually it's interesting, there are very few histories of suffrage. If you go and look up women's suffrage on Amazon, you'll find lots and lots of books. But very few cover the whole period. I'm one of the one or two. When you look at the whole period, and you run from years when there weren't even two political parties in 1848, all the way up to the First World War, the conclusion I came to was that the opposition was, in the quote you read, the crucial word is political, that the opposition, to my mind, the crucial opposition came from the mainstream political parties and the leaders of those parties. Mm-hmm. So that's why I said conventions, legislatures, and debates, political debates. Why was that the case? Well, I think there's sort of two answers. The answer that probably your audience is anticipating is straight out sexism. The idea that women are not, I mean, the right of voting was such a male, what's the right word I want to use? Such a male activity. In these years, you know, we go to vote in schools and churches and stuff. They used to go to vote in bars and tobacco shops. And men were drunk and liquor was poured copiously. And I often say it was a little bit like the Super Bowl, except that fewer women were involved in celebrating. All right, so one is the idea that this is a male ritual. I guess that's the word I was looking for. This is a male ritual, that if women are allowed to do it, like all other male rituals, it will lose its special meaning. So I think that's not, that's sort of where we would expect. But the other thing, the more political calculation, is that particularly the mainstream parties, the Republican and the Democratic Party, parties, knew that they would not be able to count on controlling women's votes. When the Republican Party, not our Republican Party, a very different Republican Party, when the Republican Party arranges for the 15th Amendment to give black men the vote, African-American men the vote, they could count on the fact that those votes would go to their party. That's another story. But nobody, the thing about women is that they're half of everything, and no party could count on controlling their votes. Moreover, at least politically organized women had gained a reputation for, by the early 20th century, being very progressive. So parties were not interested, the mainstream parties, and by the time we're talking about in the early 20th century, the Progressive Party is now the Democrats. They don't feel they can trust women. Women will are not party loyalists like their fathers and husbands. They'll go and do all kinds of mad reformist things. And for all those reasons, all those political calculations, the political powers that be, the Mitch McConnells of the day, were determined not to let women have the right to vote.
Yeah, well, certainly that may have been what was motivating the larger political structures, but certainly the way they appealed to the average male was by appealing to the male supremacy that has has been around for forever, appealing to the Bible and the Bible's admonitions that women should always take a second place to men, and on and on. And there were cartoons of men wearing aprons, you know, that men would become henpecked. And, you know, it was really almost pressing panic buttons in a lot of men. Would you not agree?
Well, I think that's true, but I'd like to qualify that a bit. First of all, I think those kinds of campaigns. First of all, I think that we should really look to the spirit, the religious, the intellectual, and the political leaders of the country who get those campaigns going. They lead the common man in that direction. Secondly, I think that those kinds of campaigns, and again, this will strike a familiar note, those kinds of campaigns have a greater power when the society itself is in some sort of chaos. It is, I think, correctly said that when there's social disorder, gender disorder is its primary or one of its primary manifestations. And finally, I would say, you know, if you look at statistics today, you will find that the percentage of men and women who support reproductive rights, the right to abortion, is not that different. It is certainly true that there is a small a minority of men who are can be counted on to pull out all the stops, including their guns, to stop abortion. I think the same could be said of women's suffrage, that men, if they were, especially if they were, shall I say, progressively inclined, could be brought around. They could. They were impressed by women's fortitude. When women started to go out in the 1910s to stand on soapboxes and argue for women's suffrage, they would do so in front of all male audiences, in front of factory gates, and they would start by being harassed and being yelled at and made ridicule jokes up, but eventually they would win over their audiences by what was at the time called their pluck. Mm-hmm. They had pluck.
Yeah. Okay. Very, very interesting. I do have to point out there are other divides, though, that still go on besides abortion. Obviously, the one that was sparked by the Me Too movement, for instance, does divide along sex lines in many ways. You know, there's a lot of different parts of this, so I just want to add that. I think abortion can be easy because abortion is against the government as opposed to individual relationships, you know?
I agree with that, and I've been saying for a while, if you don't want to have your politicians vulnerable to charges of sexual harassment, let's not even say whether they've done anything, but vulnerable, you should elect women.
Okay. And that leads us, of course, to the fact that this 75 years of struggle opened the groundwork for actual election of women. But before we get into all that, let me once again remind our audience that I am speaking with Ellen Carol Du Bois, who has written a book entitled Suffrage, The Women's Long Battle for the Vote. And the battle was three generations long. 75 years, although some people say it's 80 years. I'm not sure exactly where one starts counting, but it was a very long time. And the women who started it and their male allies did not get to see the end of it, did not get to see the victory. So, and the victory was never guaranteed because nothing is guaranteed. In retrospect, it looks like it must have been, but it actually wasn't.
Yes,
and we're offering this incredible guide to this very, very exciting and interesting period, something that it really is at the ground on which we're all standing, tonight for a pledge of $60 for a copy that is autographed by the woman to whom I'm speaking, Ellen Carol Du Bois, and it is a brilliant book. It takes fresh looks at a lot of things that it was thought were known about this period, this very long period. And we urge you to call the pledge line while we have only 5 signed copies, and order one. And you do that by calling 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602. And since this is a centennial year, and many people collect souvenirs of centennial years, you know, there's something special about them. 100 years since this all took place. You might want to get this book because that will be your souvenir and also your source of knowledge and of history. It's a history well worth knowing about. So again, 516-620-3602, as well as going to the website, give2wbai.org, and please do consider becoming a WBAI buddy. We are all hurting for cash, or well, not all of us, but a lot of us are hurting for cash, so we understand if you can't afford a very big donation, but you can have $10 a month removed from your bank account or credit card very safely, and know that WBAI will be there for you. Many, many organizations are in danger of ceasing to exist, and I have to say ours is one of them, and we need you, and we believe you need us. So enough said. 516-620-3602, and get this really great book. Okay, back to you, Ellen Carol Du Bois. Let's see, where are we? So the suffrage movement has been characterized as a racist movement. to what extent was that true? Was it not true? And to what extent were the demands for black suffrage and women's suffrage tied together in the early years of the movement, and then what split that movement apart?
Yes, this is one of the most challenging parts of this
story.
This is
a hard one.
I think I've talked about how they were brought together, and I've sort of begun to allude to what split them apart. What split them apart was not the 14th Amendment, that's also often a mistake, but the 15th Amendment. The 15th Amendment was meant to arrange for the right to vote for African-American men. And its text is the same as the text of the 19th Amendment, forbidding the states from disfranchising on the basis of the 15th Amendment says race, color, and previous condition of servitude. The 19th Amendment says sex. People didn't use the word gender. The suffrage, the women's suffrage movement split on this. I have to say that the responsibility for insisting that this amendment only address African-American men and not in a more general way the right of all American citizens to vote. It may have been inevitable, but the decision was made not by African-American men and not by their leaders, but by the Republican Party and their leaders. Mm. And the split, again, I have to repeat, it's Abraham Lincoln's Republican Party. It's not our Republican Party. The split in the suffrage movement at that time is really about whether to remain loyal to the Republican Party or not. And Stanton, particularly Stanton, she couldn't stand the Republican Party. And I tell the story about why. But she's much more interested in more politically radical parties. The suffrage movement splits at that point. Now we're going to, and let me say one more thing here, which is from the beginning, there are always some African-American women and men involved in the suffrage movement. So to say mm-hmm. that it's a white-only movement is wrong. It's certainly a white-dominated movement. But let us remember that the great majority of African-Americans at this point are living in just out of slavery and all living in the white supremacist South. It's a very different world. Okay, now we're moving forward into, as I alluded to before, we're moving into the 1880s in particular, and we're moving towards what will become known as the Jim Crow years, when the United States begins to move in a radically reactionary racial direction. Mm-hmm. And we're also moving into a new generation of suffragists, who unlike Stanton and Anthony, don't have their roots in the abolitionist movement. These women are pretty old by this time. These new leaders, and most of the people we know of in these later years, particularly a woman named Carrie Chapman Catt, otherwise quite a brilliant political strategist, they had no connection to or allegiance to racial equality in any way, shape, or form. I think I need to say at this point that Stanton herself, it's not just in the wake of the 15th Amendment, but repeatedly in the rest of her life, when she's really pushed to the edge, she just gets so angry and she says, how can women like me, as she says, the daughter and granddaughter of revolutionary patriots, which she was, submit themselves to, and it wasn't African-American men alone, but it was immigrants, it was Irish, it was Germans. Mm-hmm. And she just was enraged. She was called to task on these things by none other than her own daughter, the important 20th century suffragist Harriet Stanton Blatch.
About whom we've also written, yeah.
about who I've written. Yes, I have to say I'm quite entranced with Elizabeth Cady Stanton, so I thought the best way to get at her was to imagine I was her daughter, and I ended up writing about her daughter.
Okay. Ellen, I want you to finish this thought, but first, I'm shocked to see that we have like less than 10 minutes left, and there are some other things I want to get to, such as what finally turned the tide.
Can I suggest one topic which we talked about, which is African-American women in the suffrage movement? And I just
That's an important topic.
I just wanted to mention two of the most interesting who are from New York, actually, from Brooklyn. There are two sisters named Sarah and Susan. They were born Smith. Sarah ends up Garnett, and Susan ends up McKinney. Sarah was the first black principal of any school in Brooklyn. Probably in New York by that time. It was probably metropolitan New York. And Susan was, I think, the first black woman to graduate from medical school. And they are leading, they lived in Fort Greene, Brooklyn, which was a sort of middle-class black neighborhood. It may still be. And they form the first dedicated black suffrage organization in the early 20th century. Actually, Sarah, who's already in her 60s, travels to London in the 19-teens because she wants to see what the Pankhursts are all about.
Right, so in England. Ellen, listen, we've literally got only a few minutes. I can't believe how this is flying. This is why people have to get your book, because really go into all of this in much more detail, and they can really get to know some of these great black women suffragists who are not well enough known. It's all in your book. I want to switch, if I can, to the miracle. Well, I want you to talk for a minute about the fact that the movement was almost derailed about 100 years ago by their own pandemic, which was the influenza pandemic of 1918, and how did they maneuver around that?
Well, it's really interesting. It just sort of struck me about 2 or 3 months ago. Wait a second, you know, this subject and the 1918 flu coincided. Mostly I would say it was their determination. They were not going to be thwarted. It's also true that the flu, much like COVID, was moving across the country at a different rate. By the time they start to work on campaigns to get rid of senators who are obstructing them, and by the time they do this, they're working in places like Connecticut and Delaware, and by that time, so we're now in like September, the flu has moved west. By the time of the election, which is like November 5th or something like that, and it's a midterm, it's not a presidential election, by that time, it looks like the flu has gone away. Guess what? It hadn't. You know, so there was a second and a third outbreak. It turns out the president himself, that president, got the flu in early 1919. But so I would say mostly it was their determination and the skills that they had developed over all these years. To do what needed to be done politically. I'm sorry, I have so much to say. You're right, we have so little time.
So little time. You have to come back. We have the rest of the year to celebrate this. But I want people to also get the book, because not only will it support listener-sponsored, non-commercial, we're not influenced by corporations, we are really independent, which is unique. Not only will it support that we can keep going, but people will learn so much. You've opened up so much territory in this interview that I want to get further into. I've only read part of the book. I can't wait. Let's just spend a minute or two on what you mean, what every what would you mean as a studier of this by saying that this fight, it was not over in 1920? Can you just give an overview of why you say that?
Well, I guess I would quickly say two things. One is that it opened up almost at least another 75 years of women even beginning to claim political office. Very slow going. By 1964, there are only two women who have ever served for any length of, who have ever been elected on their own to the United States Senate. So that's one thing. And then the other is that I feel like we would be well to understand. I have taken this from my friend Martha Jones, who's going to have her own book out soon on black women suffragists, that we would do well to recognize the similarity between what we call voter suppression and those 75 long years of using every device known to man to stop women from gaining the right to vote.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right. Listen, let me just first of all alert our engineer that we want to go out with an original song from 1898, written, the words of which were written by Charlotte Perkins Gilman, expressing her frustration with what was going on in 1898 after 50 years of struggling for the vote and not seeming to get anywhere. It's called "The Women Do Not Want It," because the line that was being used was that by the male supremacists who didn't want women to have the vote, and the political operatives who didn't want women to have the vote, the line was being used that it was women who didn't want it, and they were just following what the women's wishes. And she really makes hash out of that, and I want you to hear that song. So that an original tune was put to that by Bev Grant and Carol Hainish only about 10 years ago. So we're going to go out with that. We're going to ask our audience to not forget to get this fabulous book. I don't know if the five copies that are autographed are gone yet. Call 516-620-3602. Please get this for yourself and get this to support WBAI. And I must thank you, Ellen Carol Du Bois, for coming on to Joy of Resistance.
It's been a great pleasure. You know, I too have just wanted to talk about this book more than I can tell you. So thank you so much. And I want to tell you, I'm going to sign those books when I know the names of the people who've gotten them, who've won them. I'll sign them to them.
Oh, great. So the books will be personally inscribed or dedicated to particular people who call on pledge number and order those books.
Yes. Thank you so much. And please have me back again so we can continue.
Oh, you are so invited. And I want to thank our audience, and I look forward to speaking with you again. We both do, myself and Halsey Hazard. I don't know if we'll be back next week because we are in Fund Drive. Yes, Fund Drive, Fund Drive, Fund Drive. This is how we know if we can stay on the air. Please help us to do that. Thank you so much. And here is Bev Grant singing "The Women Do Not Want It." Listen to this song.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Bye.
When the woman's suffrage argument first stood upon its legs, they answered it with cabbages, they answered it with eggs. They answered it with ridicule, they answered it with scorn. They thought it a monstrosity that should not have been born. When the woman's suffrage argument grew vigorous and wise, and was not to be answered by these opposite replies, they turned their opposition into reasoning severe upon the limitations of our God-appointed sphere. We were told of disabilities, a long array of these, till one could think that womanhood was merely a disease, and the maternal sacrifice was added to the plan of the various sacrifices we have always made to man. Religion.
The coronavirus health crisis is being politicized. Hear legendary progressive Noam Chomsky on the politics of the pandemic on the next Alternative Radio. That's Alternative Radio, heard Saturdays at 7 p.m. right here on WBAI, 99.5 FM New York, and streaming live at WBAI.org.
Thanks to you.
Thank you.
Thank each and every one of you for coming by.
And while he's thanking those folks, let me take this opportunity to thank all of you, our listeners and support staff, our contributors, our interns, the volunteers, producers, and the entire crew that works.